Good morning. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Ken Rosenthal. I'm a gastroenterologist and the head of CME. It's my pleasure to present Dr. Mitchell Scott Carl. Dr. Carl received his medical education from Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, and he completed his residency in internal medicine at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx and postdoctoral fellowship in cardiology at Montefiore. He's board certified in cardiovascular disease and internal medicine. He's received numerous awards as an undergraduate in medical school and has published several papers and has been involved in clinical research. He is currently in practice in Boca Raton Regional Hospital and is the Associate Professor of Medicine, Director of the Cardiology Teaching Rotations Boca Regional Campus of Internal Medicine Residency Program at FAU for the Charles Schmidt School of Medicine. This morning, Dr. Carl's topic is CHF associated with preserved left ventricular function and reduced left ventricular function. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Carl. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. And it really is an early, cold morning. So I speak kind of, you know, extemporaneously. You know, I don't, you know, necessarily follow the slides completely. And I want it to be informal. So if anyone wants to sort of, like, stop me at any point and ask me any questions, you know, elaborate on anything, studies that I bring up or whatever, feel free. So we're going to talk today about congestive heart failure. Congestive heart failure, just sort of broadly, is when the heart is unable to meet the physiological needs of the body. And as most of us know, you know, patients will often present with evidence of forward lack of perfusion, so they can have levito reticularis if they're severely in shock, but they can have hypotension, cold extremities. They often have evidence of JVD. Peripheral edema, hepatomegaly, sometimes they'll and left heart failure, which would manifest as rales from elevated end-diastolic pressures. So the signs and symptoms are that of usually volume overload, and usually as a result of the compensatory mechanisms that sort of over time actually worsen the heart failure. So, and by those compensatory mechanisms, I'm alluding to the extra catecholamine sensitivity and output. In fact, you can correlate sometimes the degree of heart failure by how much catecholamine excess there is, and that'll produce vasoconstriction. In fact, what you really need when the heart is not being able to pump forward is vasodilatation. So over time, the same mechanisms that are trying to sort of restore homeostasis actually make it worse. And the renin-angiotensin system is the other one, which basically causes retention of fluid, salt and water, and also vasoconstriction. And it's an attempt, basically, since you have a shift usually with poor LV function, you have a shift to the Starling curve to the right. You need more volume to maintain that stroke volume, more preload to maintain that stroke volume. So the heart tries to compensate. Of course, over time, what that does is it increases end-diastolic volumes and end-diastolic pressures, which are transmitted back into pulmonary artery wedge pressures, and you wind up with increasing heart failure. And most of the things that we use to treat systolic dysfunction with heart failure, which I'm going to talk about first, work on these mechanisms to sort of restore them back to the way they were to some degree prior to there being heart failure. CHF is the most common cause of hospitalization in the Medicare recipient population, so it's a very common thing that we deal with. So the three types of congestive heart failure that I'm going to talk about are grouped conveniently by left ventricular function. So the first is the one that's most common, let me rephrase that. It's not most common, but it's most commonly associated with CHF, or most commonly thought of as associated with CHF, and that's that with reduced LV function, an EF of less than 40%. And in fact, that traditionally, dating back up till 1982, when people thought of heart failure, they almost always thought of people who had reduced LV function. And then in 1982, this guy named Lucian was the first one to publish case series of patients that actually had normal LV function and surprisingly behaved as if they had congestive heart failure. It wasn't actually till 2001, till the American College of Cardiology and other international organizations sort of caught wind enough for that to start calling a term, congestive heart failure with diastolic dysfunction, because at that time it was believed that all these people that had normal left ventricular systolic function that had heart failure, that they in common had had diastolic dysfunction. It was then realized down the road that that wasn't even true and that a lot of these people didn't have diastolic dysfunction. So then in 2005, and until today, now we call it congestive heart failure with preserved left ventricular function, acknowledging that not all of these people do have diastolic dysfunction, particularly not at rest. So what I want to first say is, you know, cardiomyopathy is often used interchangeably as being reduced LV function. So in people that have even, you know, hypertension, valvular heart disease, congenital heart disease, it's commonly called cardiomyopathy if they have reduced LV function. In reality, that's a misnomer. It shouldn't really be used. So a cardiomyopathy should be something that directly involves the heart muscle. It can have other systemic manifestations, but it has to directly involve the heart muscle. So you can have something like scleroderma, which has, Dr. Baca, which has obviously, you know, other systemic manifestations and other things where you could make the diagnosis easily, like amyloid perhaps with a fat biopsy or lip biopsy. So there can be something that has extra cardiac manifestations, but there has to be direct involvement of the heart from that process in order to correctly call it a cardiomyopathy. So things like left ventricular dysfunction as a result of burned out hypertension effect on the heart. Initially, you get hyperdynamic LV function. Eventually, you can get a burned out, they call it burned out cardiomyopathy from hypertensive heart disease or from valvular heart disease, from an afterload associated with aortic stenosis. In reality, those things should not really be called a cardiomyopathy because they're secondary to something else that's not directly involving the heart muscle. What about Viagra? Well, Viagra was actually studied in a trial called the RELAX trial. And it really didn't have a benefit. At the end of the day, there was a lot of preliminary studies that showed that it affected certain variables in the right direction, exercise time, left atrial dilatation, things that were used as sort of proxies for people that might improve. But then when they actually did the study, there was really no benefit and actually a trend toward increased renal insufficiency. What about diuretics? Well, loop diuretics that we use for people who have reduced LV function in CHF, yeah, they work. They treat the symptoms of people that have CHF. They reduce the volume in the heart and the volume peripherally, and they make the patients breathe better, but there's no data that they change mortality. Similarly, there's no data in people who have reduced LV function that diuretics in the absence of aldactone, the only one that has been shown in reduced LV function to change outcomes. But in diastolic dysfunction, or people that have preserved LV function, it was looked at actually, and aldactone really doesn't have a benefit. That's the TOPCAT trial. But I'll get to that in a little bit more depth in a minute. So these are the treatment possibilities that have shown to have a benefit in patients who have reduced LV function in CHF, which have not been shown to have a benefit in people that have preserved LV function. So ACE inhibitors and ARBs. Well, we know that in people that have reduced LV function, they're of benefit. So I'm going to just name a couple of trials that have shown a benefit. So for people that have reduced LV function, there's the SAVE trial with captopril. There's SOLVED and CONSENSUS with enalapril. There's the HOPE trials for people that have with ARBs. There's the VALHEF trial. There's CHARM. There's ELITE 1 and ELITE 2 for losartan. ELITE 2 really wasn't a positive study, but we have studies in support with ACEs and ARBs in people that have left ventricular dysfunction in CHF. For ACE inhibitors, were universally tried in several studies for people that had preserved LV function in CHF. They were of no benefit. And for ARBs, there's the CHARM preserved. There was the I preserved, which was irbesartan with preserved LV function, didn't show a benefit. The Charm Preserve trial, which was with Atacan, did show a marginal benefit. So there's a class B recommendation that you can use Atacan for people that have preserved LV function and CHF, but the benefit was really very marginal. What about beta blockers? They did a study, obviously, in people that have reduced LV function. We have things like for carvedilol, we have Capricorn, Copernicus, the U.S. carvedilol trials. U.S. carvedilol trials, actually four different trials that were united that showed a 65% decrease in mortality, not just CHF and endpoints, but mortality in people that have LV dysfunction and are treated with carvedilol. We have the seniors trial, which used Bistolic. There's Cebus 1 and 2 that used Bisoprolol. There's Comet and Merit HF, and which used Metoprolol. So we have a lot of trials for beta blockers in people that have LV dysfunction, but the beta blocker trials in people that have normal LV function and CHF show no benefit. What about calcium channel blockers? We know that in people that are post-MI that we can use them, and it would benefit in people that don't have CHF. So there's the MDIPA trials, there's the DAVIT 1 and DAVIT 2 with verapamil in people that are post-MI that shows if they have preserved LV function, we can use those as an alternative for beta blockers. But in people that have reduced LV function, calcium channel blockers are thought to be a no-no. It doesn't help. What about in people with preserved LV function? Well, theoretically, you would want to give them what we call a lusitropic agent, an agent that allows the ventricle to fill under lower pressures. But even calcium channel blockers have not been shown to reduce mortality in people that have preserved LV function with CHF. Digoxin, in general, should not be used. It's not a lusitropic agent. It increases contractility. That's not the problem in people who have diastolic dysfunction. What about left ventricular assist devices? It's never been studied. Transplantation, of course, they'll laugh at you if you call, a transplant center and say, I have someone who has an EF of 60% who has heart failure. I want a new heart. They're gonna laugh at you. Biventricular pacing has not been shown to be effective. There are some devices, actually, that are on the forefront of therapy for people that have CHF and preserved LV function. One is something called the CardioMEMS device. We said that 95% of patients that have elevated pulmonary pressures with exercise over 45 millimeters of mercury, if they have a CHF with preserved LV function, and it can wax and wane. And if you target the therapy in terms of diuretics when they have elevated pulmonary pressures, the thought is that you might be a benefit long-term to these patients. So there's a CardioMEMS device, which actually sits in the pulmonary arteries and monitors the pulmonary artery pressures, with the thought that you could treat based on that in people that have diastolic dysfunction. And there are studies ongoing to see whether that's going to be efficacious. There's also atrial septoscopy, so septostomy. So, for example, some of us in the audience may know that there's a syndrome called Ludenbacher syndrome, where you have mitral stenosis with an atrial septal defect. And they tend to have a better prognosis because they're essentially decompressing the pulmonary vasculature by allowing that increased pressure to go to the right side of the heart. And some people are actually doing that for mitral stenosis, for people that for whatever reason are not a good candidate for either balloon commissurotomy or anything. So in people with mitral stenosis, you can often fix the mitral stenosis with a balloon, provided they don't have at least moderate mitral insufficiency associated and provided they don't have a left atrial thrombus. Otherwise, you can't do it. So what if you have somebody that's a inappropriate surgical risk and they can't have a balloon mitral valvuloplasty because of one of the two things that I just told you? One of the things that they could have is they can have an atrial, essentially you're manufacturing an ASD, and so you're essentially decompressing that pressure that would otherwise be pulmonary venous pressure and cause CHF. The blood flow can now go into the right heart. You'd think that over time they develop pulmonary hypertension, Eisenmenger's physiology, but they may or may not. But in this particular diagnosis, they've looked at that, at least in short-term studies, and they have not found that they develop pulmonary hypertension. So that's one of the things that might be on the forefront down the road in terms of devices that could help with this. So I mentioned the TopCat trial before. That was using aldosterone. We have the RAILS trial in people that have reduced LV function CHF, and we can reduce hospitalization when added to ARBs and when added to conventional therapy, including diuretics, DIG, beta blockers. In people that have reduced LV function, we can reduce hospitalization by giving them an aldosterone inhibitor by about 20%. So it was actually felt that we'd at least be able to do that in people who have preserved LV function. Aldosterone actually not only works with regard to sodium and water retention, it also in the heart itself has something to do with fibrosis. So it activates fibroblasts. So being that fibrosis and the interstitial milieu is thought to be of paramount importance in people who have preserved LV function and CHF, it was felt that it would have not only a benefit in terms of getting rid of fluid and water, but decrease that interstitial formation of activation of fibroblasts and elastin and fibrin and all these things that are felt to play a role, at least in some people that have preserved LV function and CHF. But the data by the TopCat trial proved otherwise. So there now is no benefit thought to be the case by giving people aldosterone inhibitors. But interestingly enough, someone took apart that trial as well. And in a subgroup analysis, the people that were American that were in that trial did show a benefit. So it's felt that you can at least have a level of evidence B for giving aldactone to some patients that have preserved LV function and CHF. So what about CHF with intermediate left ventricular function? So by the way, I want to allude also that some people are actually using Corlinor, because if you remember, I said that chronotropic incompetence or sixth sinus syndrome may be a part of the development of preserved LV function. They can't augment their stroke volume. They have chronotropic incompetence. So some people are using what's the other term for Corlinor? Ivarabidine. So some people are using ivarabidine to see whether that might, have a beneficial effect in these patients. So what about patients that have intermediate left ventricular function? So people that their EF is not over 50 and they don't have poor LV function, their EF is not under 40. So you don't know whether to treat them as people who have reduced LV function, which we discussed all the pharmacologic therapies that we can use and we know have a lot of data to benefit them. Or should we consider them as people that have EFs of over 50%, but it's just a little bit lower, and we know those medications are not going to benefit them? Well, it turns out that they have more in common, thank God, with the people that have lower ejection fractions than with the people that have higher ejection fractions. So they tend to have eccentric left ventricular hypertrophy. What that means is that they tend to have more volume proportionate to their the degree of hypertrophy. And they also tend to behave with regard to the Starling curve similar to people that have more reduced LV function. And they also tend to behave on a continuum in terms of arrhythmias. So the lower your left ventricular function, the more likely you're going to have life-threatening ventricular dysrhythmia. That's why Medicare says, well, people can have an EF of 35% or less, and they can get a defibrillator. But it was primary prevention. Does that mean that people that have an EF of 38% are not at risk for ventricular tachycardia and sudden death? No. They just did a value judgment of how much money they need to spend versus life saved, and they decided that there's the prevalence or incidence of these deadly arrhythmias is high enough in people that have an EF of under 35% that it's worth spending the Medicare dollars for that. It's a little less for people if it's over 35%, so if they have 38%, even though they're at risk, they're not going to spend the money. So as it turns out, the risk of arrhythmias continues on the same curve linearly as if they have decreased LV function. So the EF 20%, EF 30%, EF 40%, EF 42%, as you go up on the ejection fraction, the risk of these life-threatening ventricular dysrhythmias decreases in a linear fashion, suggesting that it may be the same disease. But we don't know. So in other words, nobody has ever done any studies in people with intermediate left ventricular function to see whether they would respond to therapy similar to those with reduced LV function or whether they would have the same refractory symptomatology as we see in people with preserved LV function. Part of that is that the criteria for intermediate left ventricular function varies. So some people use 35%, some people use 40% to 50%, some people use 40% to 45%. So because there's no consensus of opinion of the definition of the disorder, so far we don't have any good data to support treatment in one way or the other. I guess I just said this. So with that, since that's my last slide, I'm going to end and take questions. Yes.
Good morning. Maybe I didn't hear it correctly, but what is the cause of left ventricular diastolic dysfunction if it's not an infiltrative disorder? What causes the left ventricle to have a normal systolic function but yet an abnormal diastolic?
So the answer is that it's not really known, to be honest. I mean, there's all of these things that are associated, but nobody knows which is the thing that follows or which is the cause. Nobody knows which is the effect and which is the cause. So a lot of the things that occur in association with that are this protein kinase G deficiency, which has to do with nitric oxide mobilization. Cyclic GMP metabolism is altered and deficient. There's also this increased interstitial milieu of elastin and fibrin, though not universal. There is sometimes left ventricular hypertrophy, but only 8% of the time. There's thought to be increased oxidative stress. There may be more, superoxides and more free radicals around in those patients. So there's a lot of things that are seen. There might be more ischemia. There's more endothelial dysfunction. So there's a lot of things that are seen, but which is the chicken and which is the egg, nobody knows. It depends on the clinical situation. So, there's a lot of people have diastolic dysfunction by echo, but clinically they don't have a problem. They're not short of breath with exertion, and under those circumstances, it's sort of like a treatment in search of a disease. There'd be no reason to see whether pulmonary pressures rise, to greater than 45 with exercise, because although that correlates with this disorder, they don't have it yet clinically, so there's really, and you don't know what you could do even if they had it, but certainly there's nothing to do if they don't have it, and you're just looking for whether or not they've got the markers that support it. So, I think it's reasonable if they're short of breath, particularly short of breath with exertion, and you're suspicious that that's the etiology, then yes. But if they're not short of breath, then you're just really just sort of looking for something that they don't have yet, and that even if you found it, you wouldn't know how to treat it. Yes.
So what I'm getting here is that the two major risk factors for this are obesity and just an aging heart.
Obesity, an aging heart, 90% of a history of hypertension, diabetes. And the other thing that I'll mention is that the risks in people that have heart failure, the likelihood of death at 30 days, or the likelihood of rehospitalization with heart failure, is 35% and exactly in both populations, so identical. So and the risk of death at 1 year in people that are hospitalized for preserved LV function is 29%. So it's a very potentially life-threatening and significant disease, and as we age, it gets more, and the prevalence of that, and it gets more because we're less good at treating it. We're much better at treating people that have reduced LV function. So those are the risk factors. And interestingly enough, they die a lot related to the comorbidities, and they get rehospitalized related to the comorbidities. So they don't all get readmitted for heart failure. They get readmitted for things that they have. They have a higher incidence of renal insufficiency. They have a higher incidence of dementia. They have, so all of these other things, these other comorbidities tend to kill them as well. It's not necessarily related to heart failure, whereas people who have reduced LV function, their morbidity and mortality is the same, but it usually correlates to the disease process itself. Correct. So for people that have preserved LV function, for people that have borderline reduced LV function and EF of under 50%, with any element of what we think might be heart failure, there's data that we should use resynchronization therapy. So if their EF is 35% or less, they're going to get a biventricular defibrillator. If their EF is 35% to 50% and they have CHF, they're going to get a biventricular pacemaker. So yes. But in people that have preserved LV function, synchrony is not felt to be the case, and that's the issue. And that's why I mentioned before that one of the associated variables of people that tend to have reduced LV function with CHF is a left bundle branch block. And a left bundle branch block, whether it's iatrogenic from pacing or whether it's just, you know, from Levlin-Egres, which is fibrocalcific conduction system disease, which, you know, can cause a left bundle branch block. Either way, those people in general, if they have reduced, it's going to cause reduced LV function, and it can be treated by resynchronization. But people that have preserved LV function, there's no data for that. What their cardiac output is? Is that what you're asking?
Is that helpful?
I mean, you know, you can, no. I mean, you know, first of all, the conventional things that we use, which is reversal of the E to A, the E is the rapid diastolic filling phase of the ventricle, the A is from the contractility, essentially correlating to the P wave in a patient that's in sinus rhythm, and as somebody gets a thicker ventricle, they're more dependent on that atrial kick at the end to fill the ventricle, so you get a reduction of the velocity of the E wave versus the A wave. And that can actually flip in the late stages of someone that has restrictive cardiomyopathy. So it's not as easy as that, but to some degree, you know, that's what we see. But that's not even present in many, at least half of these patients don't have resting diastolic dysfunction. They only have diastolic dysfunction with exercise. So they all have diastolic dysfunction, but not necessarily at rest. And no, it wouldn't correlate to what you would estimate the ejection fraction would be, you know, which we used to use something called the Teichholz method, and then it was found that eyeballing, with someone who's in experienced hands, eyeballing ejection fraction is just as good as the formula, so everybody really just eyeballs it. But in these people, the ejection fraction would be preserved, you know, but you would still see evidence of congestive heart failure. Anybody else? Oh, yeah. Yes, I'm glad you asked that. So there is a study called the Paramount trial that was already came due. What they did was they looked at surrogate markers. They gave people Entresto basically is a combination of valsartan, which is an AT1 receptor blocker, and a nephrolysin inhibitor, which nephrolysin is a zinc-associated peptidase which cleaves natriuretic peptides. So if you can't cleave those peptides, they build up and they cause natriuresis. So the combination is what Entresto is, and in people who have left ventricular systolic dysfunction with CHF, it's been shown to be revolutionary in terms of benefit, with a decrease in mortality of over 20% and a decrease in hospitalization of over 20%. So people are wondering whether that would also extend to people with preserved LV function. And so the Paramount trial, what they did was they looked at surrogate markers, including left atrial size and BNP, and that was an affirmative trial. It suggested that things were moving in the right direction to expect that there might be a benefit. But they have not yet proven that. So now there's another study that's in process, also with a P, the Paragon HF trial. And that trial is going to be out in 2019. And that's a trial to see whether or not all of these markers truly correlate to better prognosis in people that have preserved LV function treated with Entresto. So that's the answer to your question. Anything else? Okay, thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.